Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you, of course, by globalresearch.ca. I invite listeners to visit the site. Always fresh new material, always important, always on critical world and international issues. And I can't imagine a better place to stay informed than Global Research. Except maybe the organization, well, no maybes about it, the organization that my guest this morning is the director of. His name is Peter Phillips. He's a Sonoma State University sociology professor, and he's also the director of Project Censored. PC is a media democracy advocacy group. It researches and it publishes vital news stories that are, and I quote, underreported, ignored, misrepresented, or censored by the U.S. corporate media. If you want to know what they don't tell you, then Project Censored will let you know about it. So we'll talk today about what's new from Project Censored. And Peter wrote a recent article last month, and he calls it Barack Obama Administration Continues U.S. Military Global Dominance. In other words, the baton was passed, but the beat goes on. Peter, welcome to the program.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's terrific to have you on. And this morning was interesting for me. About 30 minutes ago, I finished up an interview that I was given on a Cape Town, South Africa program, radio station. And, it was lovely. I just couldn't imagine being invited on a Chicago station to talk about the things that that I said over the airways there. My God, they cut me off after about 2 minutes.
Really?
Well, maybe a local college station would let me do it, Peter, but certainly not the major ones. We have some pretty awful programming here in Chicago, whether it be on radio or local television. And, this is what goes on all over the country.
Uh-huh.
In the dominant media, not the alternative media, but the dominant media. But let's start off.
We like to call it the corporate media.
The corporate media.
That's what it is. It's top-down corporations telling us what they want us to hear.
Oh, indeed. They have everything to sell. And who gave that quote? Everything to sell, but nothing to tell.
Something like that.
Oh, you might have been George Gerbner who said that.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the lines I wish I thought of first. But it certainly is true, and it seems to get worse as the years go by. I take a peek at it because I need to monitor what's going on for any things that I write about and also some media critiques. But it's so painful, Peter, to watch what they do. You certainly can't get informed. If you don't want to know what's going on, then tune them in. There's certainly no way to find out what really is happening. That really is the most important things we need to know about that are in our own self-interest to know.
Exactly.
But let's talk about, we'll have a break. We have 4 breaks during the program, commercial breaks, the first coming up very shortly. But maybe we can start off talking about what's new at Project Censored, then get into the article that you wrote. I think there are always things percolating. I know you're affiliated more broadly than in the past and expanding the affiliations. Let me let you start, and when we hear the soft music, I'll interrupt.
Okay. Well, Project Censored at Sonoma State has been doing research on independent news stories for the last 32 years. Essentially, what we do is validate news stories to determine that they are appropriate, that they're accurate, and they're important.
And we need to take that break, Peter, as that music is telling us. Let's do that, and then you
continue
as soon as we get back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Peter Phillips from Project Censored. Peter, let me just give you 2 plugs, and then you pick up where you left off. First off, listeners can access Project Censored by going to your website, which is projectsensor.org. And among all the things they'll find there is the newest annual edition of Sensor 2009, all the top stories of the last year and so much more in a huge book. I've got it in front of me. Oh, goodness, over 400 pages. It is just packed with vital information, and listeners can find out how to order it. And it's a very valuable addition to a listener's library. An annual book comes out each year. Next year will be 2010. And I've also got it up on my screen, Peter, your Media Foundation, Media Freedom Foundation website that is a treasure trove of wonderful alternate media sites. It also has globalresearch.ca on it. But so many wonderful sites that I know so well. And if listeners go to mediafreedom.pnn.com, they'll access this site, and they might discover a couple of new websites they never knew about that they should. But with that, let me let you continue where you left off.
Well, yeah, the portal for that, of course, is just to go to Project Censored's homepage, and you'll see PNN, which is the Personal News Network, and that gets you into the Media Freedom Foundation Independent News, which is a composite of 20 separate independent news sources, daily news feeds. So I'm looking at the top story for today from the Christian Science Monitor, which is the Dalai Lama returning to Tibet, big question mark story about that. And then you can scroll on that, and it says, China keep out. The leader fears the Tibet tinderbox will catch fire. So and that's an update from the Christian Science Monitor. It's all here, all on one page, which is quite remarkable. We have BBC, Consortium News, Bayview from the National Black Newspaper out of San Francisco, Al Jazeera in English, Interpress, the news service, Democracy Now!, Common Dreams, The Guardian. So it's a wonderful source of daily news, reads like a newspaper, and is has more news than the New York Times.
Oh, indeed. Well, it has much better news than the New York Times.
Well, I say more, but, you know, what is quality? But these are independent news sources, so you can trust these sources. They've been validated over years of research by Project Censored in that these are good organizations that put out trustworthy news.
Oh, indeed.
And we think that's vital in today's corporate media climate, that you get pieces of stories. You get what they think is what we should know, and you get a whole lot of entertainment and very little substance.
Absolutely, and once in a while, I like to use the word dominant media. Well, I do it more than once in a while. I use the term dominant media because if you throw in the BBC and National Public Radio and PBS, there certainly is a corporate tie to them. There's no question about that. The BBC in America very definitely is a commercial operation. I get BBC America on my cable lineup. And they have commercials no different than the rest of the commercial broadcasters. And NPR, they're big funders, come from all sorts of corporations, McDonald's, Walmart, whatever. I don't follow them too closely. PBS, the same thing. So I guess we could simply call them the corporate media too, Peter.
Well, I think certainly for PBS and NPR in the United States, I mean, there's certainly some good local independent NPR stations, but overall, PBS is, you know, required to, in order to survive, to take corporate money. And so you end up with not only are you, you know, you can't bite the hand that feeds you, but you end up with a very kind of narrow parameters of what news is in the United States as well.
Oh, indeed. I'm working on an article about Obama's supposed health care reform, and one of the things I discovered was that there's a FAIR study. I'm sure there'll be more on this, but they pointed out, FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and they pointed out that the debate thus far has just shut out the idea of universal single-payer coverage. And it mentioned the Lira NewsHour, and they didn't have one, so far, they haven't had one person on the program representing the single-payer side of the issue. But, of course, they have lots of people representing the other side. So it means that what's going to come out of this, there's no doubt in my mind, is business as usual will win, and health care for all, including getting close to 50 million people in the country without insurance because it's so expensive they can't afford it, and millions more that don't have enough of it, and so many more that at some time during every year they're uninsured. They better hope they don't get sick during those periods. But that's off the table, so I have no idea what the final package will be, but it certainly will not be people-friendly. And the Lira News Hour simply will not present the other side. At least I haven't done it so far.
Well, nobody is. In fact, both Democracy Now! And Fairness, Accuracy in Reporting this week has been critiquing the lack of any analysis of single-payer inside the Obama health care packages and discussions. It's just simply not there. And we were watching this very closely during the campaign. We actually have a chapter in our book this year entitled Universal Healthcare Media and the 2008 Presidential Campaign. We looked at where the health insurance companies gave their money. And they provided, I mean, all the big ones, Aetna, Berkshire Hathaway, Humana, Prudential, WellPoint, AIG, all gave money to just about every candidate as they were running, except Dennis Kucinich. He was the only presidential candidate that was talking about single-payer health care, everyone else, including Obama and Clinton and McCain, all received large amounts of money from these big health insurance companies, which have a whole lot of profit to maintain. In 2006, the top nine companies made $40 billion in profit off of our health dollar. And they do is serve as intermediaries between you and your doctor and literally will do everything to deny benefits, delay your claim, and blame you for getting sick and diminish services as much as possible. And that's the healthcare system we have in the U.S. And if we had that $40 billion, not only would all the people in the country get healthcare, everybody would have the best healthcare in the world. And, you know, it's just phenomenal that we can't even talk about that inside corporate media in the U.S. Or even PBS or NPR as a viable alternative. Oh, well, that's just not possible politically. Well, if we're a democracy, then we have to talk about what is possible politically and what the people want and need. And instead of scaring them by saying, oh, that's socialism, which it certainly isn't, the Boston Globe this week had a story about single payer, they called it the possibility of extending Medicare to everybody. And they wouldn't even use the term single payer. And it was like a one-line piece, the fifth paragraph down inside of their whole healthcare analysis of what was going on. So, it is not considered a viable option, and that's just absolutely wrong.
It really is shocking. The first Monday in April, Peter, the 6th of April, I'll have on the program Dr. Oliver Fine. He's the current president of Physicians for a National Health Program. And they really are. It's a group of 15,000 physicians who absolutely are supporting a single payer system. And I had a past. I don't think she was. I'm not certain if she was the president. Steffi Woolhandler. She and her husband. I forget his first name. Dr. Himmelstein. Among the co-founders of the organization, and she was on another program that I hosted many months back in 2007. This is a big issue. I'm on Medicare, Peter. It works very well for me. Thankfully, I haven't had to get much from it, but I did have one surgery that I certainly wouldn't have wanted to have to worry about paying for it without having Medicare. And they pretty much covered me right down the line.
And with a 3% administration cost.
Oh, that's right. I think it's actually
2%. That's the catch. I mean, these insurance companies are pulling in 30-40% of the dollar for themselves. Their overhead and their profits, it's just theft. It's absolute theft. And if you, we actually did, and the analysis of how single payer was covered in the Washington Post, New York Times, and the LA Times. And we're looking at things where they're saying, you know, that socialized medicine, that's the Washington Post last July. You'd have to wait in lines and be delayed service. Again, Washington Post. Had New York Times covering how the hospitals oppose proposals for health care, and we don't want to crowd out private insurance care. You know, they talk about choice, but, you know, so you can choose between the big insurance companies, how they rip you off, and or else you don't get health care at all. It's quite amazing. I mean, basically they're talking about requiring you to buy health insurance through an insurance company, universal care. It's kind of like a lot of states have, you know, required car insurance. You have to buy it. You violate the law if you don't. That's what they're talking about. That's what they mean by universal care.
I don't know how they're going to get people without the ability to buy this insurance, Peter. They have to buy it. I don't know how they're going to work that out. This absolutely is a scheme to try to get everybody to buy insurance, get everybody covered so that they can buy drugs. The pharmaceutical companies love what Obama is cooking up. And in the article I'm working on, I quote the president, Billy Towson, of Pharma. Oh, he loves this. You know, they might charge a little less per drug, but they'll open up a huge new market they don't have now, because in his words, half the prescriptions filled in the country, written in the country, aren't filled because people can't afford to pay for the drugs. We need to break again, Peter. Let's do that.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Peter Phillips from Project Censored. Peter, just a quick comment. I followed Obama all through the campaign, and I've written a number of articles about him, and I let him be the one to out himself. I quoted him in his own words. I went back and I reviewed his voting record in the Senate, and it certainly didn't surprise me in the slightest to see what we've been getting in the less than 2 months since he took office. The only question in my mind is, how long will it take the public to wake up and realize that we've been had again? I refer to his administration as George Bush's third term, or simply continuity. So you wrote an article about military dominance under Obama, and the beat goes on. The budget will go up, the wars will continue, the occupations will continue. This guy promised us something different, change he called it, but it looks like he has a different meaning of change than we do. Let's talk about your article, the continuation of U.S. global military dominance.
Yeah, I wrote this about a month ago, and at the time, I think the most shocking thing to me immediately was that that Obama was the first opposition party ever in U.S. history to retain the current Secretary of War Defense. This has never happened before. So Obama's retention of Gates as Secretary of Defense has never happened before in U.S. history. Robert Gates is straight out of the playbook for the neoconservatives of pushing military dominance in the world. He's a former director of one of the largest defense contractors in the country, Scientific Applications International, out of San Diego. He's been part of governments for a very long time. And the agenda is that the U.S. is going to militarily control the world. And we do that through 700-800 bases now. We spend more on military than the rest of the world combined. And that has been the agenda for conservatives, and particularly those inside the Bush administration, the neocons, for decades now. Even the Clinton administration continued military spending at solid levels, but particularly increased U.S. weapon sales worldwide. So all those defense contractors, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, we went from being 16% of global weapon sales to 63%. By the end of the Clinton administration. So that's putting all that together. Then Obama's very clear that he's not going to put anybody in who's been a lobbyist, won't be appointed to any of his cabinet. And who does he pick for Deputy Secretary of Defense but William Lynn? Now, William Lynn was the controller under Clinton that lost the $3 trillion from the Defense Department back in the 90s. And then he went to work for Raytheon. And he was the head of government relations for Raytheon Corporation, one of the top defense contractors in the country, which last year spent $6 million on lobbyists in Congress. And Lynn's in charge, then he's appointed to be the deputy director of the Defense Department, deputy secretary of defense. And he's straight out of war contractors. He'd been doing lobby work. And so he's a strong advocate for continued expansion. So this is incredibly amazing continuation of a military machine with no indication other than pulling a few troops out of Iraq, a war which is unwinnable, and increasing the numbers of troops that are going to be in Afghanistan. We're still doing deployment worldwide, expanding the military. The unemployment rates here in this country have increased people joining the military. So it's an ideal situation for a continuance of what has been in place as a policy, clearly since the Reagan administration, but, really going back to what Eisenhower talked about in terms of a military industrial and now military-industrial media complex of the United States dominating the political process.
It really is shocking, Peter, and especially at a time when we have this terrible economic crisis going on and trillions of dollars are being ill-spent on that, especially in handouts to the people who caused the problem in the first place, the bankers, the big Wall Street firms. And then we're spending... people have done some work on this, and I've quoted them. If you include every category that you could loosely define as defense, including for the homeland, we're spending over $1 trillion annually on defense, and no other country threatens us.
We can do it with 10% of that. I mean,
indeed. And we make weapons that we'll never use. We spend countless.
I hope we'll never use them. But
we're fighting the wars we're fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan right now. You don't need the super aircraft. You don't need these nuclear bombs or whatever the super missiles that they have, and all the crazy things they may have on the drawing board that we don't even know about. The idea isn't that we need them. The idea is to pump tens of billions of dollars into the big defense contractors because, as you say, they lobby so effectively that they get back many times their investment in these huge boondoggle contracts.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Oh, we need to take another break. Let's do it, and we'll both pick up the venting when we come back, Peter.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Peter Phillips from Project Censored. Peter, I've had Chalmers Johnson on this and an earlier program twice. He came on. Before we ever had an economic crisis, he talked about the military spending as bankrupting us and doing the same thing to us that the Soviets went through, and that all came to an end at the end of the 1980s. Among other things, they just spent themselves to death. They just couldn't keep it up any longer. So before we started pouring trillions into criminal bankers, we're spending all these countless billions, plus all the black budgets we don't even know about. Heaven knows how many billions are being spent through those, CIA, NSA, all the rest. There has to be a bad ending to this somewhere down the line. Plus, all of the commotion we're kicking up all over the world, making enemies. We can almost compute it on a per dollar basis. the more we spend, the more enemies we make.
I think that's essentially correct. I mean, we've been knowing for a long time that the continued spiral of military spending leads the world to nowhere and creates the long-term possibility of civil unrest and insecurity worldwide. We now have, you know, over 3 billion people in the world living on less than $2.50 a day. A billion of those left living on less than a dollar a day. That's insecurity. That's global insecurity on a mass scale. So somehow the political elites and the industrial elites of the world think that having big militaries is going to, you know, be the way to control unrest worldwide, and both you know, in foreign countries, but also domestically. Now that we have troops stationed in the United States to occupy any city in case of civil unrest, posse comitatus is out the window, and Obama is not sending those troops back or telling them to stand down. That homeland security is very much in place, and very much does the White House have the power to suspend habeas corpus for anybody they choose, occupy and declare martial law in any city in the United States or regions or entire states. That's still all in place, put and expanded after 9/11 in the Bush administration, but it's not being dismantled. It's certainly still there. And to watch this continue after there was so much hope in the Obama, you know, victory for so many liberals in this country, and middle people too. I mean, just people right smack in the middle of the political spectrum, and even some many to the right, seeing, you know, this continue, there's going to be huge disappointments down the road here. We'll see incremental changes. They're going to call it, oh yeah, we're going to have universal health care. Oh, by the way, get your pocketbook out so you can pay for it. And then the massive the massive loss of jobs and the collapse. I mean, two of my best friends, you know, lost, you know, one lost 100,000 in their retirement plan. The other one lost 70,000. You know, they're both nearing retirement age. You know, they don't know what they're going to do. And millions of people are faced with this across the country. And, you know, this idea of people, you know, that big boom of people that are approaching 60 now, born after World War II, having some terms of long-term security, that's out the window. And it's, you know, that so people are going to be angry and upset, and the response from the elites is going to be police and military repression.
Peter, I actually remember back when I was a college freshman or sophomore, I forget which, back in the 1950s, and I had just taken an economics 101 course. I thought it really told me what it was all about on things economic. And I remember telling my father, Dad, you don't have to worry. We won't ever have another Great Depression because we really learned what we did wrong and we'll never repeat those mistakes. So just rest easy and everything will be fine. Well, I never thought then, looking back, that we would reach a time now where we still don't know how bad this will get, but it is pretty, pretty bad. And before it's over, we may look back and say, my goodness, this was worse than anything we ever had before. And I know Michelle Chosudovsky absolutely believes that this is worse than the Great Depression, and the policies that are being instituted aren't making things better, they're making things worse. I've had economist Michael Hudson on this program who pretty much feels the same way. We're just throwing more fuel on the fire, making a bigger fire. We have a huge debt problem. We're piling on tons more debt, exacerbating the problem. And Hudson refers to it as a coup d'etat against the system that we have. The bankers are winning out, the big financial interests, including the real estate interests, the insurance interests, the big guys. Not the little guys, not your neighborhood bank or your local independent insurance agent unaffiliated with one of the big ones, but the big people who caused the problem. And none of this ever should have happened. So we're in this terrible calamity. Also on this program, Peter, I've had economists say since last November we're losing about 1 million jobs a month. This fiction coming out of the Labor Department, 500,000-600,000, whatever it is, probably without question closer to 1 million. And how long this will go on, I don't know. So even if Obama somehow magically created 3 or 4 million jobs, my God, in 3 or 4 months we're losing that. So there's no possibility of keeping
the balance. Doesn't work. The balance doesn't work. And, you know, that massive loss of jobs. I mean, the World Bank is predicting loss of 50 million, and these are full-time, you know, often industrial jobs around the world this year. Let's put those people out. China has already said they've laid off 20 million people. Their orders are down by 50% worldwide. Global trading is off substantially, and there's absolutely no light at the end of this that says, oh, it's all going to get back to normal, and your mutual funds will get back up to, you know, what they were, and that's just, it's not going to happen. And, you know, having continuing wars, I mean, we've killed over 1 million people in Iraq. And when I say we, because the United States invaded that country, over 1 million people have died. And half of those died from U.S. military aerial bombing or home invasion, literally. Patrols in neighborhoods. And that number has finally, you know, been validated. By the Nation magazine ran a piece in February, written by John Terman from MIT, looking at the statistics of death and the surveys that we've been talking about for a couple of years now, saying, yep, there's been 1 million dead Iraqis. And, you know, so as the, you know, center left national kind of Nation magazine comes out and finally admits that, yes, there's 1 million dead people, you know, that's phenomenal that we've actually, you know, had the direct result of killing that many people in this war. And the public outrage has to be there. And, we're bringing that war home every day with the veterans who've been through these terrible ordeals. It's just unrest. It's instability and it's long-term, danger to not only American people, but the world, to continue this obscene military expansion and adventurism. It's just wrong.
Absolutely, Peter. And, of course, you could go back to the Clinton years in the 1990s. Last week, just about a week ago, I had Dennis Halliday on the program, the UN's humanitarian coordinator, 1997 and 1998, on the so-called Oil for Food program. And he resigned. I quoted him a number of times, but we talked about his experiences. He resigned back then because, in his words, he was asked to commit genocide. And he talked about a million deaths in the 1990s because of the sanctions.
Because of the sanctions, yeah.
Just because of the sanctions, a million deaths. And he referred to 5,000 children a month dying because of disease or whatever, absolute lack of the essentials. And even that so-called Oil for Food program, I remember mentioning in one of my articles, the numbers stick out in my mind, roughly what they were, something on the order of the equivalent of 15 cents a day for food and 4 cents a day for medications. So the whole program was a fake. And something was being done, but it was so little that all of these people were dying, thousands and thousands of people dying a month from deprivation. And Halliday wouldn't put up with it. And the other humanitarian coordinator, Hans von Sponeck, he quit, too, for the same reason. I think Halliday was the most eloquent. And we had a wonderful discussion.
I remember Dennis several years ago before the war and him talking about that, those issues. And it's just completely, you know, what we don't know, or what wasn't told to the American people in regards to during the Clinton era, not only in Rwanda, but Iraq, and the millions of people that died because of U.S. policies, are we could have easily impeached Clinton at that time, certainly not because of Monica, but more because of millions of deaths that were perpetuated by U.S. policies. And You know, we look at the world today. There's every day 30,000 people, mostly children under five, die from malnutrition or very easily curable diseases. That's every day in the world. And for most of us, I think if your child was in danger of death, you would do literally anything to try to save that child's life. And that's the insecurity that's in this world today. And we have more than enough food to pay everybody, I mean, to keep everybody healthy. We have more than enough resources to have a global village of peace and prosperity. But we have a centralized command structure of corporate power in the hands of just, you know, 1% of the world population, dominating, controlling, and using military, using dictatorships to control the people in the world. And that can't last. It won't last. It's going to crumble someday. And we hope that we don't take the whole world with it.
There's no question that it'll crumble someday, Peter. We're an empire like all the others. All the other empires went down. Some lasted a very long time. Rome lasted a very long time. But every empire following the path that we're on now has met the same fate, and we are not exempt. We will go down, too. You're right. I just hope we don't take the world down with us. Heaven only knows. Rome was powerful, but they didn't have nuclear weapons and the kind of stuff they have today. God only knows what they might do, even by accident. I think the accidents worry me more than some damn fool deciding that, well, it's perfectly safe to drop these nuclear bombs on a place like Iran. Oh, my goodness. And we put people like this in positions of great power, great authority. Isn't there anybody around who realizes, my God, we simply can't do stuff like this?
I think there's a lot of people around that realize that, and so many people feel powerless. And even listening to us talk on the radio is one thing. But, you know, people, you can engage politically, you can write about this, you can respond and organize. We have a daily censored blog now, and we invite people to come and put up and tell the world how they feel about these issues and participate in those kinds of ways. I mean, the Internet offers, at least at this point, the opportunity for talking about these issues around the world to millions of people and pushing it and engaging and challenging the powerful in every way possible. I think that will continue. We do have ways of communicating with each other, and that is part of this whole movement for democracy in the world.
Peter, what you do at Project Censored is so vital. There's no question in my mind, and I've felt this way for so long, the state of the media is issue one, because if people knew what was going on, the big stuff, if they knew what was going on, they absolutely would not put up with this, because it's hurting us, it's touching our lives, and it's affecting us adversely. They simply don't know. They tune in to CNN or a local radio show of whatever so-called news or talk or whatever it is. The media, the local media in Chicago is absolutely atrocious. And our public radio station is terrible. And our PBS station, I know at one time, was considered the worst PBS station in the country. That was quite some time ago. I don't know if they still have that distinction. But this is the state of Chicago media. There's a couple of good small college stations, but they reach a tiny audience, and even they spend most of their time playing music, not having informational programs. So it really is terrible. People don't know what's going on, and they don't realize how their government's policies are harming them. This has to be the top issue.
Well, you know what's happening worldwide, of course, and is resistance and grassroots democracy building. I think, and those are where we see the corporate media in the U.S. Talking about dictators and that sort of thing. I think one of the best examples right now is Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. He's winning every election down there by, you know, two-thirds of the electorate, the lower classes and the middle classes of the country are saying no to the historical political elite there. And they're building a democratic socialist movement. It's part of the Bolivarian movement that's happening throughout South America. America, in Ecuador, in Brazil, and in countries throughout the region. And they keep winning these elections. They have, in the November election, they took 81% of the mayor positions, 17 of the 23 of the state governorships. They got over 1.5 million new voters voting for the United Socialist Party of Venezuela. This is bottom-up democracy. They've got 25,000 community councils in every neighborhood prioritizing the needs in those. They now have 400 radio stations and 34 TV stations run by the people in the barrio. That's grassroots democracy and media in action. They started printing presses and printed, millions of books last year and distributed them to these community councils. These are books on, the classics of Victor Hugo and Cervantes, and I remember seeing Cindy Sheehan's letter to the president down there. Millions of books going out into the communities, into community-based libraries. So there's a whole dramatic transformation of society going on in South America in resistance to the U.S. Sponsored elites down there, and it's quite an amazing experience to see that and watch.
Absolutely, Pete. You went down there. You visited. You saw for yourself.
We were down there last November.
Oh, it's one of them. Not perfect, but Chavez is really trying. Chavez is a leader that really wants to serve his people. Perfect? Nah, nobody's perfect. But imagine if we had a president like Hugo Chavez in this country. He would kick up some dust. Peter, we need to take another break, and then we have a short segment left. Welcome back. A final few minutes with Peter Phillips. Just in Venezuela, Peter, you've got Venezuela analysis on your site. Venezuela analysis, I forget if it's .org or net or com, but anybody could Google Venezuela analysis, and it's a terrific website to find out what's going on down there. We could only dream that what they're doing there would happen here. Peter, I think you know. They actually have written into their constitution that everybody in the country gets free health care. Everybody gets free education. Imagine that in our constitution.
I visited the Venezuelan University, Bolivarian University in Caracas, which is housed in the old oil ministry building, and saw, the health clinic on the first floor, the free food cafeteria there, visited the classrooms, talked with faculty and students. There's no charges to go to the university. They have 8,000 students, and the only thing the students have to do is buy their own books. It's just an amazing thing, that the enthusiasm, their concerns about what's happening in the U.S., their enthusiasm for democracy, for helping and building a democratic Venezuela. Was amazing to me, and I saw very, very enthusiastic students talk with them. It was just a phenomenal experience.
And at the same time, business is doing very well in Venezuela. Not quite as well now as a year ago,
the price dropped out of the oil market. I mean, part of this was when you had oil at $150 a barrel, there was lots of money to spend on working people and the poor in Venezuela. Now, that's been cut down by 60% or better. We're down at $40 a barrel now. So that impact has certainly had a negative impact in Venezuela, but they're certainly continuing. And Chavez, in order to make sure there was plenty of food, had nationalized the rice plants because the elites would tend to hold back and try to create an even greater unrest. And so they freed them up.
Oh,
and the community markets there that are subsidized in the barrio neighborhoods will bring in commodities and rice at below market prices so everybody can eat.
And for the people who can't afford it, they subsidized food. They subsidize
exactly.
A lot of things. And even with lower oil prices, Peter, Chavez is still very committed to using the country's revenues to help the people. It's built right into the budget. They keep stripping it out of us, and he keeps doing it in his. We are nearly out of time. Let's tell people again how they can go to projectcensored.org. They can find out all about Project Censored. everything that you're doing, Peter.
You can see our daily news site. There's a big button called PNN. That's the daily news from the independent news sources you can respond to on the Daily Censored blog. You can see all the stories historically. We have archives going back 32 years now, stories not covered by the corporate media.
Oh, it really is incredible. I mean, that history is glorious. We won't be around, but I hope 132 years from now, the people running it then, Peter, can say, you see, we just put the shoulder to the wheel and look what we finally accomplished. I hope a lot sooner than 132 years. But next month I'll have Mickey on again. We'll pick up the story then. We'll update things again. What you're doing is too important not to keep people current on, Peter. So I want to do it, and my hat's off to you for the wonderful work that you do, your commitment, and everything Project Censored and everybody associated with it is doing. What would we do without you?
Well, thanks very much, Steve. You keep doing what you're doing as well.
Oh, I'm pushing as hard as I can too, and I welcome listeners to come back tomorrow. We'll go back on the global economic crisis. John Bellamy Foster will be my guest. He's written a wonderful new book. We'll discuss it on the program. Join us then.